So shall we make a start? It's 5:30. We've had, as you know, two lectures, and they've touched on both land issues and farming issues and food as a material substance. We've spoken about waste. We've also spoken about different kinds of what I suppose people these days would refer to as agents. We've spoken about individuals as consumers, growers, producers. We've spoken about the retail sector, both the formal and the informal, the hawkers, the supermarkets. And today Jane is going to turn her attention to food policy. So this is about government, about rules and regulations, I guess, Jane. And there's this wonderful hopefulness that Jane's inscribed in the title, the idea that at some stage we might be able to arrive at having an urban food policy, never mind a national food policy. Jane, looking forward to what you have to say.
Good evening, everyone, for the last time. Thank you for coming to all three nights. It's been a real privilege. Is that close enough? Okay, is the microphone working at the back? No? All right. Keep going. I'll try and get a bit closer to it. Right, perfect. I don't know if you saw the front page of the Times today, where we had a food security story on the front page. And ever since then, I've been in strategic planning meetings all day, but every time I go into my office, the phone is ringing off the hook with journalists. So I've done a few radio interviews today, got a potential TV interview on Monday, and there's this energy around the food system. People are interested in what's going on. But one of the questions that people keep asking is, well, what's going to happen? You know, we see this problem, why isn't anything being done about this? You know, maybe people didn't know about it in the past, and now we know, so why isn't the government doing something? Why aren't civil society organizations doing anything? And so tonight I just want to try and work through what I think is some of the blocks that prevent action from happening and how we might untie those. And we're going to look particularly at the policy gap. So I think this is really important. If we unblock policy gaps, then we can provide all kinds of spaces for civil society, for corporates, NGO sector, concerned individuals to get involved. So it's trying to understand where those gaps are. On a slightly random front, yesterday I was listening to the radio. And they were talking about the British cycling team in the Olympics. Remember, you watched the Olympics. The British cyclists won 7 out of 10 gold medals. And they're asking, how was it there was this dramatic improvement in the British cycling team? Was it drugs? Well, probably not. Maybe in a few years' time we'll find that out. But they said, here's an interesting thing. They employed somebody called the Director of Marginal Gains. And they worked with all kinds of scientists. They worked with somebody who designed hot pants that these cyclists wore between warming up and starting the race, because they realized that if you get cool, you lose your energy. So they were wearing these hot pants. They realized if you rub alcohol on the wheel of your bike before you start the race, you have better traction. So all these little marginal gains. And so this is what we're maybe thinking about with the food security problem. What are those marginal gains that we can make? That, you know, some might be agricultural science, some might be social science, some might be consumer pressure. What are all those marginal gains that can be made? But in the British cycling team, it took somebody with authority to create that post of Director of Marginal Gains. And so this food policy gap, we think, is that thing that stops us making those marginal gains. So how do we get beyond that? Because the truth is, in South Africa, the right to food is a constitutional right. Like the right to housing, like the right to adequate water. The right to food is a constitutional right. And yet it's been largely neglected. There is no city in South Africa that has an urban food security strategy. There's no mandate for cities to address food security. So in 2002, the government instigated the integrated food security strategy that was designed to try and address the challenge of food security and address the right to food in South Africa. It's housed in the Department of Agriculture, and we'll come back to why that might be a limitation just a little bit later. Increasingly, the government's recognizing food insecurity as being a challenge. So the diagnostic review of the National Planning Commission called food security a key shaping force for the country. and yet in all the articulations around this, it's always focused on food insecurity as being a predominantly rural problem. We might have moved away from this productionist notion, but predominantly the idea is that it's a rural challenge. So if you look at this excerpt of the Integrated Food Security Strategy, we look at what the foci areas are. So it's increasing household food production, improving income generation and job creation, so poverty alleviation is part of the solution, improved nutrition and food safety, so regulation of the food system, social safety nets, improved analysis and information management system, so trying to track the food through the system, capacity building, stakeholder dialogue. Nothing in there is explicitly about the urban, and nothing in there is explicitly around the changing food system. Remember, we were talking about the consolidation of the food system in the first lecture. There's nothing that's acknowledging that. The focus is on poverty alleviation and smallholder household food production. Sort of categories C downwards have largely been neglected. Most of the focus of the action of the Integrated Food Security Strategy has been in this A and B, household food production and poverty alleviation. And so all the way through, food security has been seen as a rural problem. So if you look at how it's been articulated, they talk about national food security, they talk about household food security, but where that problem is articulated in the rural. So the Integrated Food Security Strategy says one of the primary objectives is to overcome rural food insecurity by increasing participation in rural food insecure households in productive agricultural activities. So immediately it's in the rural, and we can solve the problem by increasing productivity. The ANC's election manifesto listed food security as one of its five key areas, but it coupled food security with rural development. The National Planning Commission has spoken about food security, but in the context of food security, water security, and rural development. So all the time there's this re-articulation of it being a rural problem. When you go a little bit deeper into the National Planning Commission, again, you see this rural bias coming through. It talks about household food security should include using and expanding existing public works programs, in particular, the community works program for rural infrastructure development should be used. So time and time again, we're seeing this coming through that it's a rural problem. Just last year, the DA put out a statement on a Freedom from Hunger campaign. I haven't seen where that's gone, but this is what they were articulating. And they have a slightly more nuanced take on the food challenge. So they are talking about a lot of things around the cost of food and doing food price monitoring. So they're certainly getting more to some of the access challenges that we've been talking about. But implicit in this, as all the food price monitoring, is focusing on food price monitoring in the formal food sector. And as we've seen, and as we'll see again tonight, the most food insecure are not buying from the formal food retail sector. So how do we get beyond that? So there seems to be this challenge of articulation that frames food security as being a rural problem that we can address through greater household food production. But again, to come back to some of the findings, because I know we discussed this briefly on Monday, but I want to go into a little bit more detail now. Within the African Food Security Urban Network, when we rolled out the survey across these 11 cities, 77% of households we surveyed were either severely or moderately food insecure. Cape Town came out at 80%. So clearly there is an urban food security problem. One of the questions I've been asked over the last few days is, well, to what extent is this better or worse than the rural areas? There was a survey done in Klipplaat in rural Eastern Cape that used the same methodological tool as us. So you're comparing like with like. Okay, in Klipplaat in Eastern Cape, they found 100% of their sample were food insecure. And, you know, we only found 80%, so clearly the urban isn't quite as bad. But when you look at the severity of the food insecurity, and the severity is in blue, in Klipplaat, 69% of households fell into this severely food insecure category. But in Ward 95, which was the Khayelitsha site, 80% fell into severely food insecure. So there may be greater reach of food insecurity in rural areas, but it appears that the severity is perhaps greater in urban areas. And this also starts to indicate that food insecurity in rural areas and urban areas manifests differently. It probably doesn't have the same causes, and as a result, it probably doesn't have the same solutions. So the national policies that are being rolled out with an urban, with a rural resident in mind are not going to work in urban areas. So we need to think about what might be an urban response. So when we looked at what people are eating in urban areas, and our raw, more food friend in the front might be very disturbed by this, we looked at all the 12 categories that people could eat. This is what urban residents were eating. 93% of households had in the last 24 hours consumed some kind of cereal-based food. So maize, often bread, sometimes rice, that sort of thing. The next most commonly consumed foods were these. Other food. And again, if you're wondering, other food was generally tea and coffee. So your most commonly consumed food is cereals, followed by foods made with sugar or honey, followed by foods made with oils and fats. That's not a good diet by any stretch. And so it's no wonder that we see these high levels of urban obesity, these high levels of urban hypertension in poor communities. So people are malnourished, but people are fat. We're seeing increasing levels of type 2 diabetes and type 2 malnutrition in the same sites. And the question is, why are urban people eating this badly? And there's a number of reasons. Partly it's around the foods that are made available in urban areas that are less available in rural areas. But a lot of it is about how we live, move, and have our beings in cities. If you think about traveling from Khayelitsha to the city center every day on public transport, the kinds of choices you're going to make around the foods that you're eating are very different. You don't have time to do a slow cooked meal. So we were expecting to find a lot of this category, a lot of households consuming foods made with beans, peas, lentils. It's a low cost, it's a high nutrient content food, and yet there was hardly any of that. And so it's around these things like how long do you have to prepare your food, what kinds of cooking technologies are available to you, what's the cost of cooking food? You know, with electricity prices going up, with gas prices going up, paraffin prices going up, it's often more cost-effective to buy something pre-processed along the way. And so we're seeing there's something around the way we live in urban areas that shapes how we eat. So when we looked at where people were getting their food from, we saw these trends. We saw most households were accessing the supermarket, but not that frequently. So sort of once a month or so, households were going and doing a bulk buy, which was a little counterintuitive because we know that supermarkets are often cheaper. We know that supermarkets often have a better range of produce. So why go there less frequently than the informal trader, where the food is not notionally lower quality and higher cost? And again, it's around this urban life. It's that the supermarkets are not located close by, that you can't afford to go there frequently. If you're not guaranteed of what your income's going to be, you buy piecemeal. You don't plan a month's worth of food. And so it's that kind of the urban economy all sorts of ties into this. So we found high proportions of people accessing food on a daily basis from the informal trade sector. The few other things that were really surprising to us were the very low proportion of households growing any food. And so when you look at the policy response, which is often around urban agriculture, it doesn't seem to be the obvious solution for the people. And the other element was this high proportion of households borrowing food from neighbours, sharing food with neighbours. And what we tended to find was that households would run out of money in the last few weeks of the month and depend on social networks. At the same time, when households run out of money, they can still go to the informal trader and get food on credit. So this is an important aspect of how the urban food system is working. And so when we're designing an urban policy, we need to be able to think around these kinds of issues. In addition, when we're thinking about urban policy, we need to think about a lot of the issues that Gareth was talking around yesterday, about the sustainability of the food system and how do we plan for that? Because focusing just on the household, we missed that big picture. And then we need to think more about this larger food system that we're talking about with the Philippi Horticultural Area as a case study. This notion of the farmer consolidation, the way in which the food reaches from the farm to the household. All of those things become important. So when we've got this kind of evidence, and we're not the only ones who've got this kind of evidence, the case for urban food insecurity is growing all the time. Why do we see this persistence of a rural framing? And so I just want to, this is going to be quite technical, so stick with me. Three reasons why I think that we're not seeing change. And it's ideological, it's methodological, and it's around the location of the food security strategy currently. So let's first look ideological. Internationally, there's still the hangover from the urban bias theory. In the 1970s, a guy called Lipton was working in particularly in Africa and focused on the apparent historic urban bias towards urban areas. The idea that because of colonial legacy, post-colonial legacy, we've ended up in a situation where wealth, power, and influence have been concentrated in urban areas, and the rural areas have been sort of underdeveloped as a result. And so there was a big push in the 1970s and 1980s to try and redress that imbalance. And so this notion arose that the urban areas were the sites of wealth and that poverty was concentrated in rural areas. And we still live with that lag. So in 2001, the UN Habitat Report noted that some of the largest development agencies operating in Africa had no urban department. In fact, to argue for urban was seen as being almost counter-revolutionary. So there's been this kind of neglect of the urban. There's been this ongoing idea that rural people are poor, urban people are wealthy. We still see some of that legacy coming through today. That follows through in South Africa with our own particular history. As we know, this year marks the centenary of the 1913 Land Act, which was part of the process of systematically removing poor black people from urban areas to rural areas and generating, again, this notion of a poor rural area, a wealthy urban area. And we're still living with that particular legacy. So there's still this notion that if you focus on urban areas, again, you're supporting rather than challenging the status quo. And so to argue for urban food security issues is seen as somewhat counter to the national interest. And so we've kind of got this ideological framing that reinforces the idea that poverty and therefore food insecurity are rural problems. That then hooks into methodological. How do we make these measurements? Because more and more I'm realizing that how you measure something is determined by how you think in the first place, and it reinforces the kind of arguments you can come out with. So to give you three examples. The kinds of figures that have informed national policy thus far have used these large surveys, like the General Household Survey, the October Household Survey, Income and Expenditure Survey, and they've spoken to food security, but they haven't explicitly asked about food security in a very in-depth sort of way. They've used blunt proxy tools. So for example, Income and Expenditure Survey looks at levels of income, levels of expenditure, total expenditure on food, and from that extrapolates notions of who's food secure and who's food insecure. The October Household Survey has asked, has anybody in your household ever gone hungry? And then extrapolate food security from that. But food insecurity and hunger are not the same thing. Hunger is kind of the extreme end of food insecurity. And so by just identifying the people in absolute hunger, we think they're missing a lot of people who are struggling with food and missing a lot of the causes that mean that people end up in food insecurity. So we think these kind of blunt tools have obscured their true extent. And so you end up out of those massive surveys with statements like the 1995 Income and Expenditure Survey said that 27% of urban households were food insecure and 54% of rural households were food insecure. National Food Consumption Survey of 1999 said that 42% of urban households were food insecure compared to 62% of rural households. So you see these kind of big figures, and they seem to support the idea that food insecurity is a rural problem. But when you start to delve a little bit more into how they've actually made those measurements and what assumptions are going into that, you start to get questions. There's also this kind of rural versus urban. And that A, we think rural and urban are much more connected than we'd ever imagined. So work we've been doing has been looking at rural households and how they connect to urban households and the remittance flows and all those kinds of things. So there's not this straight rural-urban division. There's also kind of tricks of the trade that go into this, and I don't think they've been fully recognized. So there's this blurring of percentage versus numbers. To give you an example straight out of the Integrated Food Security Strategy, that says that Gauteng and the Western Cape are wealthier provinces with the least number of poor households, with less than 12% each. The least number and 12% are two quite different things. A population and a proportion are very different things. So again, in the Integrated Food Security Strategy, they argue that Gauteng has less of a food insecurity problem than the Northern Cape, because Gauteng has 6.1% of its households living on less than 600 rand a month. Okay, so Gauteng has less than 6.1. The Northern Cape has 21.7% of households with that same income boundary. So using the proportion, it appears that the Northern Cape is worse off. But when you look at the number of households, you get a different picture. So 6.1 of Gauteng's population is 119,000 households. 21.7% of the Northern Cape's households is 40,000 households. So using percentage makes it look like the Northern Cape has a greater food insecurity problem than Gauteng as an urban province. But if you look at the absolute numbers, it seems that the problem in Gauteng is at least equal, if not far greater, than in rural areas. And so there's that kind of question about how do we measure things and the way in which numbers are used to reinforce an ideology. And so what we're saying is, well, maybe we need to do a case study approach. Maybe we need to look at areas in rural areas and areas in urban areas and compare those. Because if you're just comparing these blanket rural and urban, you're not going to see the real thing. The other thing, and this is the last kind of technical point, because I realize this is not very interesting, but it really makes a difference to how policy enacts. So the last one is, how do we define what's rural and urban? In most countries, it's around the number of people concentrated in the area. So in Sweden, if you've got more than 1,000 people, you're urban. I think in places in Latin America, if you've got more than 100,000 people, you're urban. In South Africa, it's around what kind of political jurisdiction you live under, which has meant that a lot of places that would really be considered urban by any other means are considered rural. So historically, Kocabela, which has got about 150,000 people, has been considered to be a rural area. This is a poor area, and the poverty figures and the food insecurity figures from there fall into rural. But by all other measures, it's urban. So even just how we define rural and urban make a real difference. So the ideological issue of food security being associated with rural poverty, and poverty being a rural phenomenon, and then the methodological mistakes, all kind of feed into this idea that there's not an urban problem. Finally, the fact that food insecurity is dealt with by the Integrated Food Security Strategy, which sits in the Department of Agriculture, again reinforces this rural idea. So all of these things kind of concatenate to make this notion that food insecurity is not an urban problem. And so the outcome of all of this is that we end up, just trying to go back to this slide. The outcome of all of this is that we end up with no urban mandate for food security. There's no city Department of Agriculture. So the Department of Agriculture, who's in charge of food security, can't really do anything in the urban areas. The cities have no mandate to do anything about food security. It's not part of their job. And I think we're very fortunate to live in a city that takes its power and responsibility very seriously and wants to be accountable to its citizens and doesn't want to be seen to be overreaching its responsibilities and overspending on things that aren't its mandate. But that means that very little's getting done about food security. The result of everything being housed in the Department of Agriculture means that when cities do want to take initiative, they follow the lead from the Integrated Food Security Strategy, which means that we have a number of urban agriculture responses. And there's nothing wrong with urban agriculture, but it shouldn't be the only response that we seek. Also, the fact that there's no mandate means that it's very ad hoc. So the city of Cape Town instituted an urban agriculture policy in 2007, and we're still the only city in South Africa that actually technically has an urban agriculture policy an urban agriculture unit. I went up to a meeting with the National Department of Agriculture last year, and there were 10 municipalities there, all running urban agriculture programs, and all housed in different departments. There's one in Department of Health, no, not Health, there's one in There's one in Environment, there's one in Spatial Planning, there's one in Local Economic Development, and they were just trying to fit it somewhere. And so it wasn't very much a strategic program, it was just something that they felt they needed to do. And so we kind of got this ad hoc process going on. And so we're left with not a lot being done. And from our perspective, and building on Papa Kuchi's work, if planners and all other departments in the city are not conscious of food issues, then the impact is negative, not just neutral. So for the rest of the lecture, I just want to run through kind of, I think, some of the negative consequences of not having an urban agriculture policy, of not having an urban food policy, and just showing where some of those gaps come through. So the first response is, well, we expect that the market's just going to provide food. Rural areas produce the food, the market provides the food to urban areas. But as I showed you on Monday, the supermarkets, the main markets that are envisaged within national ideology, are predominantly located in wealthy areas of the city, which again makes it difficult for poor people to access the market. So this notion that the market will provide and we just let it happen is a little bit misguided. Again, even the companies that are trying to target the low-income areas are still missing the lowest-income areas. And the thing is, because the city doesn't have a food mandate, they're not really tracking this process. So I asked somebody in the city, well, how many new supermarkets have gone in? Because we're concerned about this rapid supermarketization, this kind of popping up of the supermarkets in every township. They weren't able to give a ready answer. They were tracking the number of developers who'd applied to put in malls, but they didn't have a sense of how many shops of food-saving shops were going in there. So it's kind of an unmonitored process. And if we're not sure what the impact of these supermarkets on informal traders, if we're not sure what the impact is on people's ability to continue to access food, then that's a real problem. And so by not having a food mandate, we're not tracking this, and we might be having negative impacts. The second element is this informal food market. We know from our research, we know from anecdotes, we know from more in-depth research that my students have been doing, that the informal market is the vital port of food security for an awful lot of the urban poor. It's the primary source, it's where you go when you don't have any more money, it's where you get local produce, all of those things. And yet again, the city doesn't have a mandate to think about the informal food retail sector as a food retail sector. It thinks of it in terms of local economic development, it thinks about it in terms of livelihoods, it doesn't think about it in terms of the services that it provides. And so there's a lack of engagement. I can't remember the figure. I'm going to make up a figure. If anybody knows me, knows the number, you can correct me. But something around more than 20% of Cape Town's GDP comes from informal sector trade. Now, that's interesting because the department in the city that's in charge of informal sector trade has precisely 2 full-time staff members. And so there's this lack of engagement with that system. And if this is the vital source of access of food for the poor, then surely something needs to be done. And so the lack of food mandate prevents the city from thinking about this sector in terms of food and is unable to plan for enabling the system to work better. And so there have been a number of cases of food traders moved on, food trucks impounded, and all these sorts of questions, and it's all on regulation. If you only got 2 staff members, you're going to be rolling out regulation rather than empowerment. And so, again, if this is the vital source of fresh produce for the urban poor, surely we need to have a better response. We need to be thinking about how formal and the informal sectors relate. So this is a Google Earth shot from Philippi. And I find this fascinating. So this is the ShopRite Centre on the corner of Lansdowne Road and New Iselwyn Road. It's been there for, I think, since about 2005. It's got a ShopRite. It's got two fast food outlets and a furniture company that sells a lot of goods on hire purchase. And so this is the local economic model that's being pushed. But just outside of the boundaries of the shopping mall are all the informal traders setting up. And so there's a lot of fresh produce being traded outside. There's an awful lot of relationship between these two sectors. You can see the taxis outside. These cars are not private cars. These are informal taxis operating within the township. They call them cockroaches. And they're Toyota Cressidas, and they will give you a lift. When you're off the taxi route, they will give you a lift home. So there's this real dynamism and connection around this local food economy. And yet this isn't really being tracked and isn't really being understood. And one of the biggest changes we've seen in the last year, and I don't know if anybody else is aware of this, the location of social grant disbursement has been changed. You used to get the social grants from the post office, I think. Yes. Social grant disbursement now is going through the supermarkets. So ShopRite and Pick and Pay. And so that's dramatically changing how people are engaging with the food system. So you go to this place on payout day, and there's queues out of the centre, and people get their money. There have been allegations that the supermarkets actually hold on to 100 rand until you spend money in store, but we're not. I hear it from our local bogey, so I'm not sure if it's entirely true. But it certainly ties people into this formal food economy in a way that hasn't been necessary before. And so we're seeing this dramatic shift, and again, because of the way in which food security has been understood, because of the way in which the food system is seen as sort of operating outside of policy, rural food security, production, none of these things are really being assessed. And we think these have potentially profound impacts on food security. The final element comes back to, well, how do we govern land? So we go back to Philippi Horticultural Area, and the area is getting slowly eroded by development. But we have both the right to housing and the right to food in South Africa. And the right to housing is trumping the right to food every time. And when we've spoken to the city, there's a number of people who want to protect the area. There's people in a number of departments who are keen to try and hold on to this as productive agricultural land. But because the city has no funding, has no food mandate, they're unable to act on a food basis. So we come try and make a biodiversity argument, we're making a water argument, but we can't make a food argument. And it just seems a little strange. And so, yes, the Philippi Horticultural Area is unique in that it's in the city, but all of our cities are growing rapidly. And oftentimes, the most productive land is on the hinterland of the city. And how then, without a food mandate, do we protect those areas? So just going through some images quickly, these are all from some of the city's documentation. In the first map, we see that down here, the Philippi Horticultural Area has this... the Philippi Horticultural Area is seen as an area that has good aquifer potential. In fact, the area that's getting taken over for development next is the area that has the highest aquifer potential. We look at another map, which has the Philippi Horticultural Area again, looking at municipal open space. Areas that are seen as being critical and significant are in the Philippi Horticultural Area. In fact, some of the areas, that are listed as most critical are in the areas that are getting taken for development. A last one, looking at protected conservation areas, it's seen as a biodiversity hotspot, and yet again, it's getting eroded. And so the question is, well, how do we shift that? How do we recognize the agricultural potential and the role that this potentially has for food security? Finally, I think there's a part of the clue is in how the calculations of agricultural potential have been made. So I know this isn't an easy map to see, so I'll try and explain it. But the brightest green areas are areas of high potential and unique agricultural land. Okay? most of Philippi falls into the second category, which is agri areas of significant value for local protection. Now, if you look at the areas that are of high potential and unique agricultural land, they largely are forestries and are vineyards, not our food producing areas. And so what are we saying is of high agricultural value here? And again, it's that notion that we need to understand the value of food and the value of food security in our cities, but because we don't have a food mandate, we can't make that argument. So, concluding, you know, we see that food security has been a critical challenge. I think hopefully over the last few days you've got a sense of the extent of the challenge, some of the impacts of the challenge, and again how, you know, if we start to think about food, we can unlock a lot of development challenges to the country, including sustainability. Seeing that food isn't simply a problem of poverty, but it's around systems challenges. It's the problem of the food system, it's the problem of the urban system. And yet, the way in which policy is being framed makes it really difficult to make any response. So what we're trying to suggest is that within the national food security strategy, a particular focus comes down to the urban and a partial mandate is given to cities to start acting, because we think that will begin to unlock some of the potential to make some changes. Because as soon as we do that, then a space opens up for those marginal gains to be made, for attention to be made to where food retail is located, for an argument to be made to protect agricultural land, for different kinds of social services to go in place that will help people access food, for transport planning to be designed with food in mind. So we know that a lot of people access food and taxi ranks on the way home. How do we manage to locate food retail better so that people can maximize that? How, when we're designing housing, can we think about low energy storage that's going to help people keep their food longer, keep their food safer? Different cooking technologies, all of those things start to be unlocked when you provide that space. Not only that, it provides the space for civil society to engage. So Gareth very briefly yesterday spoke about the emergence of the idea of the Food Policy Council across the world. And again, it takes a city to have a small mandate for food, which enables them to open up to civil society, enables them to open up to academia, to develop these sort of think tanks that speak to the food challenge and find creative solutions. Because as it is, the lack of this mandate is fundamentally blocking that potential. And so we sit here and we think, well, what are the solutions? But yet then when we ask questions at the end of the session, it's clear that there's an awful lot of knowledge about the food system in the room, and there's an awful lot of people who have experience in engaging in working towards solutions. So we just need to be able to create a space in which those voices can come together and begin to act. I think I'm done. So I think we've now got quite a lot of time for open conversation at the end. Thank you.
Well, what a wonderful exposition about gaps, holes, neglect, omissions. And the real challenge, it seems to me, is the one that Jane poses, wearing her hat almost, of the Ways of Knowing project that I spoke about right at the outset of the sequence of lectures. How do we improve things if we have such poor data and information? And how do we begin to formulate policy when we're so ignorant about what's happening on the ground? And secondly, how we've got to think about how the ways in which we measure things predispose certain kinds of policies, and whether alternative measurements about shortage or absence or lack or nutrition, volumes, might lead to different kinds of policies. So there's a lovely intellectual struggle going on here about how do we actually know, how do we get information, and secondly, how do we translate that into policy and action and overcome this horrendous gap in our cities. Let's take a round of four questions. I'm going to start at this side of the room today because I feel I've prejudiced that side of the room. So, lady over there, one. Lady in the back, two. Lady with the green shirt, and the man in the back with the white shirt.
Does the Philippi area, the vegetable producing area, fall into city urban edge policy? Is it mentioned in that? I would have thought that there would have been some safeguarding of it, if it is, in that policy, and also in the integrated development plan.
My question is the sociological barricade to micro development in the city in Soweto? I was really involved in collecting urban households to do a door for your med size of a door and pull the paper and the food plaza and build one of the little venture gardens. And at the same time, you're giving hot boxes to households. The lentils and the beans and everything. Now, surely over 50 years or 40, 55 years, there has to be a sociological reason why that isn't being done all throughout all the townships all over South Africa. Because we're all trying to do in urban areas where we don't need to.
The lady with the green shirt?
My question is, any information do you guys know of what the steps were in other cities around the world to create food policy councils or similar bodies, and perhaps added on to that, what could we do here?
I'm going to check with one.
Yeah, look, it's a question and a statement. I think, first of all, you're missing a lot of very important points. You take Philippi as a first place. It's one of the most protected areas in Cape Town, which is very successful. Better part of 50 years ago. In spite of the efforts of many developers to put housing there, it still exists, which I think is quite critical. This is the city of Cape Town and the Cape Provincial Government. It is being attacked now, it's true, but on the whole, it's mainly that it still exists at the time. Second point in the same line, which is not mentioned at all, Act 70 or 70, the Agricultural Protection Act, which is alive and well and has survived changes in government and policy. And you have to deal with it as soon as you move on to any other agricultural land that you identify with the open. And right now, I've got one of my colleagues who's busy dealing with this in Victoria, most of the nice things that are standing to the problem of open. And then your inference that the distribution of food would improve city, any city, not to mention the city of Cape Town, Bolivar, I dispute the rest of it. It is an informal, successful, as you mentioned, market-related food supply running right across all the wealthier and the poorer areas of Cape Town. In fact, it's not poorer areas. I'm sure it comes across. And I dispute that any kind of governmental organization would ever be able to more efficiently distribute food than the private sector is at the moment. Private sector food distribution is running at a worldwide scale. Sure, the prices are up and down, but the fact that the biggest cities worldwide gets food, so that everybody gets it, that's another question. But I dispute that a governmental organization would ever know be better at it than the private sector. We all know that inadequacy of bureaucracy, I haven't been able to personally very well, we've been in the day. And in spite of the best efforts, the best intentions,
the questions get more challenging every night. Does Philippi fall under the city's urban edge policy? The Philippi horticultural area is technically outside the city's urban edge. There are currently efforts to move the urban edge, so the Scarp Kraal smallholder area is now going to fall within the city's urban edge, and that's the Vanguard Drive station is also going to fall within the city's urban edge. So we're in this sort of slightly complicated management situation there, in which the city has some legislation and some of it falls outside. It has been protected over the years, and it is amazing that some of it still remains. But when we've looked back at historical IDPs and other documents, there have been repeated statements around the need to protect this area for perpetuity, and yet it does continue to get eroded. So yes, there's a lot of efforts to maintain it, but it does seem to lose up more often at the moment than, I mean, we know that 7 472 hectare piece has effectively gone. You know, there's another claim on about 200 hectares on the southwest, so there's an increasing pressure. sociological barricade to micro-development. This is one of those questions that comes up, and people often want to ask whether or not it's anything to do with the South African social grant, and does the grant make people lazy? When we mined into our data, we found that actually households that were getting a social grant were actually slightly more likely to be doing an alternative livelihood strategy. In some ways it seems, particularly with urban agriculture, households that were in receipt of an old age pension were more likely to be doing any gardening than other households. So it almost seems as if the social grant, particularly the old age pension, which is that much higher, provides the kind of income stability that you need in order to make an investment in a business or a livelihood strategy. So there's that element that comes through. We do think, in certain cases, it's something to do with the geography of the city. So when we looked at our two different sites, the Philippi site had a lot more informal traders working in it. It had a lot more people renting out properties, working in the transport industry, than the Khayelitsha site that seemed to have very few options. So there's something around geographies of our cities that perhaps makes it more difficult. Why people aren't gardening more? It's a long-term strategy that has risks. There's a number of people who work directly in urban agriculture projects who I think would like to have the floor, so I can probably back off that. I think there's enough expertise in the room. But I'm delighted to see the hot boxes are coming back in. There's a company called Wonderbag who are rolling out hot boxes. And they've done a great job because they realize that actually marketing a technology to poor people as a technology for poor people doesn't go very well. It's seen as patronizing, it's seen as, you know, what the wealthy people don't use this, why should we? And so they've actually been marketing to the wealthy markets as well, in trying to break that notion. So I use my hot box quite a lot. I think I'm going to invite Gareth to speak to the Food Policy Council story, because Gareth's actually been doing a bit more direct research on this notion. So.
What has been very interesting for me in trying to understand what has initiated these food policy councils is that, again, and every city and every region seems to have a different set of processes and practices that take place, but to speak broadly to it, what appears to be the case is more often than not, the food policy councils, that their operation sits at, maybe let me start at another point. What has initiated that is an enabling environment where the city is able to actually speak to civil society and other groups. So what Jane mentioned there is a critical component of that. So where the city is able to draw in and use funding in a developmental approach or in other forms or ways in which to capacitate those conversations around the development of an organization that works with government but sits outside the state, or the state, but the city, and how those work. So that environment is a critical component to it. Where that environment is not present, often there are also groups that work, and they work outside of government and outside of the city. So they act almost as someone to check on the city, to challenge them, and to respond to them in that space. What is now starting to emerge, and this is particularly in the US, so not so much in the European cities, is that it's happening more at a district municipal scale. So it's looking at more of a broader food shed and a realization that things happen not just within the city, but that blurred relationship between the urban and the rural starts to come into play. And so it's happening in the US at a county level and others at a slightly broader level at a district municipal level around that. What is very interesting as well is that in my work at the moment and looking at about 200 of these food policy councils, I would argue that about 50% of them actually are formally appointed by the city to assist cities in doing this. So there's a recognition of participative governance and other forms of processes that are there. Whether we're ready for that and that, how that might play out becomes a different challenge. Of the other 50%, about half of those are really organizations that challenge government, and the other half are sometimes contracted to do research, and so they play a role where they have a partnership with the city. The last point on it is that what seems to be the case around some of what is happening at this county scale in the US is in response to the state, the American US state-driven policies that the cities are, and the regions are fighting against. So it's often the cities and their citizens are challenging top-down policy things. And what we are seeing, what Jane articulated around a policy model that doesn't necessarily work, or development strategy like letting fast food outlets run amok in cities and things like that, then the cities themselves are responding to that. So I don't know if I've properly answered it, but there's a mix of how these are originating and where they're coming from.
Okay. And then just coming back to the question of the state of food distribution. Absolutely. We all know the state is inefficient at most of the times, but I think the point I was trying to make was thinking around things like the informal trade sector, where the city has, not just Cape Town, where cities have tried to enable the informal trade sector, they've often missed the mark. And so at the moment there's a lot of discussion around generating high streets in township areas. Sustainable Livelihoods Foundation, who've mapped all the informal food, all informal trade in places like Brown's Farm, and what they've found is that the highest concentration is areas that have a lot of footfall, but a lot of the focus has been on the areas that are perhaps main roads rather than footfall areas, and so that perhaps is why some of those schemes have been unsuccessful. I've got a student who's looking at informal food retail around transport intersections. And two of the intersections you've been looking at, the guide plans worked quite well. In one, just the micro planning, it's 2 meters further back from the passers-by than it should be, and so the trade has been unsuccessful. So those kind of micro-scale things, and this is why, as researchers, we're quite keen to try and help engage and really do that sort of micro-scale research that will help unlock some of that potential. The other area is perhaps something that has been tried in Brazil, which may not work here. But in Belo Horizonte, they also recognize this phenomenon of food deserts, of supermarkets not being located in poor areas. And so they entered into a contract with those companies that said, you will be able to locate in the most profitable areas you want. You will sell particular products at set prices to guarantee that things are affordable. But on that basis, every 2 weeks or so, you will hold a mobile market in a low-income area and guarantee low-cost food goes into those areas. I don't know if that would work here, but it's an idea about how to address some element of market failure.
Let's take another round of questions. Lady in red, lady in black, gentleman in blue, gentleman in the front. Lady in red.
Surely it's a good thing to keep the supermarkets out of poor areas, because the minute you spend your money there, goes out of the community. If people are spending their money with informal traders, that money is circulating in the community. It's not going back to wealthy shareholders.
Lady in black? Blue? Whatever the colour is.
Yes, black. Just in response to the sociological barriers to food gardening, I did some ethnographic work around low-cost housing and how people actually use their land. At a few community gardens, and we actually found, and also from the points you mentioned about the ideological barriers, why we aren't looking at urban people, we found that people who had moved from the Transkei to Cape Town were wanting to leave rural. how the people didn't want to grow. And most of the community food gardens were only being kept alive by old cohorts from the transplant who remembered and loved garden. So that was just a comment. And then I was interested in the little green patch on the map near Rondebosch and closer to the mountain, which was agricultural protection.
There was another green patch.
Does that green patch mean
potential
agricultural
use? There's a dark green patch there.
That's
no, there,
closer to the mountain.
There's
big green.
Stenberg.
On Stanchester. That's vineyards and forestry.
I'm very concerned from a health point of view about nutrition and how our food, for all the growing that we do, and what's actually getting into people's bodies and how it influences health and how much that costs our city and the health departments every year so much. Where do you see the sort of places to intervene in the system to try and influence people's food choices? So I was once in the Golden Acre one morning when people was rushing and streaming in from the taxi rank into the city and stopping to buy breakfast at their home at 5 a.m. And everything for sale was like oily, sweet donuts, and that's what people are having for breakfast. Where, how can that be influenced?
It's a bit like a campus food offering. Gentlemen in blue, can you make it snappy, please?
No. When I grew up, we used to have the services come to us. A horse and cart or a lorry brought us veggies, another one brought us bread, another one brought us milk. My mother, she shopped once a week by bus. How come the poor areas don't have movable trading sites rather than fixed ones?
Okay. And gentlemen in front of you.
Yeah, a very thought-provoking course. I've got two thoughts. Cheap urban food supplies seem to depend on low wages being paid in the agricultural sector. What are the implications for food security if farm workers are paid a decent wage in South Africa? Secondly, the point about how much food comes into the city. How much food goes out of the city? This is actually one of the world-leading export ports for agricultural exports, particularly 319,000 tons of apples, that compares with your 91,000 tons of vegetables from Philippi, 255,000 tons of grapes, 170,000 tons of pears a year. We're on the technological frontier when it comes to our management of the cold chain, getting fruit from farms here out to other countries, but we have food problems in the city.
Because nobody's responsible for it, no one's making money out of getting it done. And there's no education.
Okay, in the interest of time, because we need to be out of here by 6:45 at the very latest, and I know I've got a supper to go to, so food security. Is it a good thing to keep the supermarkets out of poor areas? I think it's very easy to say good or bad. I think we need to understand that we act a bit better. Certainly encouraging local businesses, but a lot of the supermarkets are local franchises, so they are actually owned by, but the profits still go out. In an ideal world, we would have a better balance. The rural ideology.
Sorry, can I just interrupt here? Yeah. Vis-a-vis better balance. I mean, we're living in a society where, I don't know, where I get the impression that there is a lot of pressure being brought to bear on industry to participate in the community. You will have a soccer team, you will have a canteen, you will have a school. You will operate on the basis of a community goodwill system. Is that not pertinent to a supermarket?
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of the supermarkets do have these corporate social investment programs, but ironically, oftentimes, they're not addressing food challenges. So if we can get the supermarkets to have more of a food focus, that would be perhaps an interesting response. Low-cost housing, community gardens, using backyards for shack dwellers rather than for gardens, that's a challenge. The notion that it's a rural practice, I mean, we found people who've been in the city for 20 years and never wanted to farm until they retired, and then they were willing to do that because they'd established themselves in the city. So we know that that comes through. Health and nutrition, and how do we change people's diets? I've got a student who's a dietitian who's actually working in community at the moment, trying to understand why people are eating what they're eating. Because there's no point in having these nutritional guidelines if people don't want to take them seriously. So they're trying to understand what those barriers are. There is certainly something around trying to ensure better food goes into the informal trade sector, and again, that's more or less impossible. But there are some people who want to set up mobile food vendors that will be selling home-cooked, better-processed foods. So there are these maybe points of intervention, but it's not an easy answer. Mobile food vending, there are Bucky Smoser who drive around, particularly fresh produce traders. And we still have our guy coming in to Birdfleet. But they are operating, and there are plenty of food retail opportunities in low-income areas. And then finally, the question I've been avoiding all week, the farm labour question. It's interesting when you look at the absolute cost of something in the supermarket and what proportion of that actually ends up at the farm. And so, which I don't have the graphic, but I'm just trying to remember, when they were doing an expose of the apple price in the UK, and they traced it back to South African farms, I think 5% of the cost of the total cost of the apple went to farm labour, additional 5% went to the farmer, and the bulk of it was around the distribution system, the transport system. And so I don't think that a significant increase in farm labour costs will have a direct impact on food prices. I think that can be absorbed. The concern is the margins that the farmers are at and whether or not it will push them out of business because they are price-taking from higher up in the food system.
So can one not kind of reduce the cost of transport?
Gareth, won't you come up here, please? I'm going to ask Gareth and Jane in a moment just to give us a concluding thought, a quick summary and some pertinent point or two for us to take home with us. But I'm sure you'll agree with me that having sat through 3 hours of this conversation and discussion, it's very, very hard to leave and not think differently about what some people call the metabolism of the city, the flows of energy and food and waste, and indeed the metabolism of our own bodies, and so on and so forth. It's been fascinating for me. I hope you too have found it fascinating. And thank you for coming, and thank you for your questions. For us, an occasion like this is a real treat to test ourselves, to listen to an audience with very different sorts of experiences and frames from the normal folk that we talk to, in the younger and the students have different experiences and attitudes. So thank you all very much for coming. It's for us a great pleasure to be here and to have the opportunity to engage with you. Gareth, your last thought, and Jane, your last thought.
I think really for me it's, again, just to echo Gordon's thanks to everyone, to be able to try and articulate some of the work that we're working through at the moment, and it's definitely a work in progress. This is new stuff, really, although some of it is very old stuff and seems very logical, but to try and understand what is going on in the urban system with this new urban transition, this urban transition taking place, becomes a very exciting space, and to get all the really great questions and to be challenged. And For me, I do still maintain that I think looking at food and trying to understand how a city functions and the challenges we face, the opportunities we face, food provides this fantastic lens to start asking questions and peel away at the onion that we might try to get to. And it's not always an easy process, so thank you very much.
I think the final point is, we spent a lot of time talking about the challenges of food, the problems of food, the nutritional issues, but the reality is it's food. And I think if we lose the pleasure of food and the satisfaction of food and the ability to savour our food, then we lose touch with the food system. So I would just ask that you leave this course and go and enjoy food properly.
Thank you all.